I'm Beth Golay, and this is Marginalia. Karen Russell is a novelist and short story writer with many bona fides. In 2009, the National Book Foundation named Russell a 5 Under 35 honoree. In 2011, she was awarded a Guggenheim Fellowship. Her debut novel, Swamplandia, was a finalist for the 2012 Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. She was also the recipient of a MacArthur Foundation Genius Grant in 2013. And her latest novel, The Antidote, was a finalist for the National Book Award. It is an American epic set in the 1930s, immediately following the Black Sunday dust storm. Set in the land of Uz, Nebraska, it has a little bit of everything: basketball, prairie witches who collect memories, a magical camera, a scarecrow, and so much more. In anticipation of the paperback release next week, we thought we'd revisit the conversation we had with Karen Russell when The Antidote first came out. You wrote in your acknowledgments that this book, in some form or another, has been with you for nearly a third of your life. Can you give a brief description of The Antidote and share when and where it began for you?
Yeah, absolutely. My friend who's better at math pointed that out to me, and I was stunned actually to think about how much of my lifetime I've really been thinking about this place and these people. I was finishing my first novel, which is called Swamplandia, and it's set in the Florida Everglades. And my joke back then was I was writing Drylandia, you know, like set in like this, a very arid time and place. And I think actually it just took writing this book to realize that they're really connected at the root. I got this image when I was finishing that novel about a woman who was holding this antique hearing aid, an ear horn. You know, if you've seen, they look kind of like gramophone horns. And someone was whispering something into it. And it's going to be a book about these living memory banks and also a collapse of memory. I just had this idea of these women who kind of, you know, they're often marginalized or, you know, some they've suffered some tremendous loss that's like sort of torn a hole through them. And then they rent that out as storage space, essentially. So people will come and whisper pieces of the past that they just find unbearable or maybe too precious, right? Something that you want to put up the way you'd put a keepsake in a vault. And they call themselves the vaults. And so this lady haunted me for a long time. And I knew it would be set during the Great Depression and the Dust Bowl drought. I had been writing in this first novel about the dredge and fill campaign of the Everglades, which was kind of a campaign of colonial capitalist expansion through my home of South Florida. I was interested in that time period. My own grandfather and grandmother worked for the Civilian Conservation Corps and the Works Progress Administration. I was sort of haunted in the earlier novel by these cycles of dispossession. That book was about a family whose alligator wrestling park was about to be foreclosed on, but it was also about, like the fantasy for sale in my home state and kind of the real histories and possibilities it covers up. And I think this novel in a real way is sort of circling some of those same questions about, well, what have many of us forgotten kind of privately and collectively? And like, what kind of possibilities would we be able to see if we told fuller stories about our country's origins, about our own families? So that's a long, long answer, Beth. I always have too much coffee to prepare for these things.
I really loved the way you tied together thematically, I guess, like three of your plot points, because you just mentioned these women had a hole torn in them through loss. But then there was also the deposit of memories into the Prairie Witch's Vault and the documentary photography project for the Resettlement Association. The latter was run by Roy Stryker, who would punch a hole into photo negatives to reject them. And the witches' customers had holes inside them where their memories were. So there's like three things that have holes in them. And some of these, you know, the images were included in the book, even with the black dot where the hole was. Could you talk about that theme?
Yeah, absolutely. And if some of your listeners are interested or history nerds like me, you can now go to the Library of Congress website. People will be familiar with photographs like Migrant Mother by Dorothea Lange and, you know, the photos of Gordon Parks, Walker Evans. I mean, we know these, even if we might not know their attribution. And a lot of what I knew about the Dust Bowl came from this amazing, vast photographic archive that begins during the New Deal. And so one of the characters is this photographer, fictionalized, right? Not one of these. These all have gone on to be, you know, some of our iconic photographers. And they get their start in this unprecedented, you know, state-sponsored, New Deal-sponsored project, you know, sort of designed to in its inception, really make propaganda for some of these New Deal relief programs and to kind of show the need for and the success of rehabilitation program, you know, aid to farm workers, you know, to give sort of urban America also a picture of the rural poor and the suffering on the plains, which is what this fictional photographer is sent to document. I just became sort of obsessed with this project. And there have been some art exhibits around this. You know, it took me so long to write this book that, you know, it's like other people also became fascinated by this shadow archive. And you can just see these hole punched literally in the beginning, kind of the Roy Stryker, who was the founder, kind of the architect and the director of this program, would just put a hole punch through certain negatives. And, you know, it's not always clear what the rationale for that is. Sometimes it's very clear. It's like, oh, this was the stronger of two nearly identical shots. So he's putting a hole punch through the duplicate. Sometimes it seems like there might have been, it might be like an act of political curation. And there's sort of stuff to support that. Reading in some of the correspondence with photographers, you know, in one letter, he tells Dorothea Lange, take pictures of everyone, you know, take pictures of the white and the black, but lay the emphasis on the white because, you know, white farm workers, that they'll have a greater likelihood of being circulated and published. And this is also at a time where the Southern Democrats control the purse strings of Congress. The New Deal is very, very new and controversial. So he has a whole kind of a world of political calculations he's making as well. This is another long answer, but I thought looking at that hole punched through some of the negatives, a practice that his photographers deplored and that he later abandoned. And what's sort of interesting now is to kind of look through that. I think for me, there's one picture in particular, it's Rural Pupil by John Vachon. It's this little boy, the hole punched image. The hole gets punched right above his ear. He's sitting in a classroom. Something about that really grabbed me. And it was on my desk when I was writing this novel. And if I had to choose like one image that really is sort of the heart of this for me, it's this little boy with the hole punched through his ear. And I just found myself thinking a lot about what we never get the chance to sort of know fully. I felt this, you know, I was thinking a lot about the blinders installed in me very young, right? Or just a very partitioned way I had. This would be a local example of that, right? Like I really knew the Dust Bowl very narrowly through Steinbeck's masterpiece, The Grapes of Wrath, you know, through photographs like Migrant Mother. I didn't really connect it to other historical events that I did learn about, right? But sort of in a different unit, right? Like in a different box with a different frame around it. So, you know, the US war on Native nations, right? I never connected that as a young person to the Dust Bowl or to ecological collapse. So a lot of the project of this book was really, I really wanted to kind of widen the lens for myself, first and foremost, I needed to do that, right? And kind of consider what holes had been punched, you know, what the way that there are these sort of strategic attacks sometimes on people's understandings of their own lifetimes or very deliberate omissions, you know, in mainstream accounts, in institutions, in textbooks, but then also some of this stuff can happen so, it's so fast moving, it's so private, it's like in your innermost heart. It's how you carry the secret cargo of your own past, and you might not know the way that in aggregate it becomes a kind of mass denial. So that is a little bit about what that hole came to mean for me, and also that it could be a portal, that it's not all lost, right? That, oh wow, there's a line in this book, many songs have been lost, but not all songs have been lost. And I think that was really moving to me to like sort of look through that hole and see, oh my gosh, like there are all kinds of living possibilities that I think I speak for myself that I haven't really considered, or different ontologies, different ways of living with nature, for example, different practices, different agricultural practices. And I think, you know, that's all part of looking through the hole too.
You know, the novel included stories and information from the Genoa U.S. Indian Industrial School and the Milton Home for Unwed Mothers. So institutions like these were government-funded and often church-run. Can you tell us about them and what you discovered?
Yeah, absolutely. And this would be another, you know, part of our ongoing history. You know, I think there is no American Indian family that's not touched by the legacy of these schools. I think there's more conversation around them there. I think some of this is kind of, this history is coming to light through the concerted efforts of a number of people. I had the real beautiful opportunity to witness some of this work. I went to a meeting of the Digital Reconciliation Project at the University of Lincoln. And this is sort of an effort to bring this particular school's history to light and also to bring history home to the Native American families and communities and the relatives of students at these schools. And you mentioned the Milford Home for Unwed Mothers. So I think originally my biography for this woman who calls herself the antidote and makes her living absorbing memories for people is that her child was stolen from her at the Home for Unwed Mothers. And I was doing more research about this particular place. I mean, it was set in Nebraska. This was the first state-funded home for women who are pregnant and are single. And at this time, that's against the law. So it's a really interesting case study, and you can sort of feel a very charitable impulse that feels genuine to me. I think that there were people who really wanted there to be a sanctuary or a refuge for destitute women who were in pretty dire straits. But it also becomes a place where there's incredibly cruel. It's a very cruel institution. If you read about the ins and outs of daily life there, there's punishment. They have different straitjackets for different trimesters of women's pregnancies. If you're sentenced to a year there by the courts in some cases. So women, you know, if you were sentenced to such a place and you miscarried or you had a stillbirth, you had to remain there for the rest of the year. And you can see some of the values and attitudes of that time, the way, I think for me, the horror story there was watching maybe a sincerely good, right? Like a real wish to help somebody get warped by some of these attitudes and structures. You know, oftentimes these adoptions were coerced and, you know, poor immigrant mothers, for example, were sort of really pressured to give their babies to white Christian families. You know, that was one way this story could go. It's really hard to know. I mean, I'm sure some of these adoptions were voluntary, but reading about this place made me think a lot about the context in which a choice is made. And, you know, how it can be a pretty weak yes if there really are no other opportunities and if the courts are telling you that you're sentenced to such a place for a year. It was, it's an hour drive from this progressive era institution to the Federal Indian Boarding School. There were hundreds of these schools all over the country. And Native students were essentially kidnapped from their families. This was also, you know, it was illegal to keep your child with you. And at these schools, Native students were forbidden from speaking their languages, from practicing their religious and spiritual beliefs. There were places of kind of coercive assimilation. People that I spoke to were very clear that the goal was ethnocide, right? That they were really designed to sever the ties between Native students and their families and communities. And so I thought there felt like there was a real through line between these two institutions. And I was also really interested in the people who survived them and this tremendous life wish that carried real people, idiosyncratic people, individuals through these places.
You know, although this was set in the 18 and 1900s, it felt so timely at times. When we learn of Tomasz Oleksy's deposit, he said that in Poland, the Reich demanded that all children read and write in German. And just like you mentioned, students at these schools were not allowed to speak in their own language. Speaking in Polish was banned in public when he was still in Poland and Germany had taken over. Oleksy was told that in Nebraska he could speak his language anywhere he wanted. You were writing like a historical novel, but did it feel timely to you?
I think it really did. I mean, I was also, you know, we've seen a lot of attacks on women's bodily autonomy in recent years, a lot of protections that I think many of us, I speak for myself, you know, I really, they felt foundational to life in this country, now feel like they're threatened. Really, I was really struck by some of what's happening in Florida, where I grew up, I think leads the nation in book banning and kind of censorship in libraries and schools. And I just found myself thinking, wow, this is this history that is ongoing. And the contest for the future plays out. The front lines are, right? Like the Home for Unwed Mothers made that clear to me. It's like control over your destiny and your body, the way that we teach history. Because if you don't understand that, right, if you don't have a full picture of the forces that have shaped your life, I mean, that was really maybe my takeaway from writing this book. I was like, wow, a lot of us may not have all the tools we need to understand our own lives and also the tools to imagine alternatives. That was very much on my mind, watching some of the litigation around like, well, what books get to be on library shelves? What do students know about? You know, I will say I took my kids to Frontierland not long ago. I somewhat begrudgingly went to Disneyland. I wouldn't say there's been a significant edit to Frontierland since I was a child. And some of that really surprised me, right? You really just get one side, you know, the aggression is really inverted at a place like that. And so I think that was really on my mind too. Just, I will give you another example. Like I grew up loving the Laura Ingalls Wilder books as a kid. And I had this idea that the dugout was this quintessential pioneer architecture, you know? And I think I sort of, the way I understood the settlement of the West was like, nobody was really there. And people miraculously survived these incredibly cruel conditions. I would have had a very different, even if what I learned was factually true, this omission of the long lineage of the indigenous people, the original people of these regions, from my understanding, meant that I never connected a dugout or a soddy with, you know, for example, in this book, there's a picture of a Pawnee Earth Lodge or Mud Lodge. I didn't have that sense that this was sort of a newcomer's adaptation of a much older architecture and a native architecture. So that would be just one specific example, I guess, of sort of that felt very connected to the present too, where some of the stories that we're passing down, the focus is very narrow, and who and what get omitted have enormous consequences for our collective future, I think.
I have one more question about language, because that same character, when he moved to Nebraska and was learning English, he was recognizing the Indian words in the English. And you know, where I am right now, Wichita, Kansas, to use a reference from your book, these are not Yankee words.
No.
And he realized that what was happening to the Poles in Germany was happening to the Pawnee in Nebraska, and no settlers tried to stop it. So talk to me a little bit about the short memories and the willful omissions of what even the settlers, who were not so recently experiencing the same thing, how they chose to turn their own blind eye to it.
Right. I think there's a refrain in this book. I have sometimes thought it sounds a little like simplistic, just in paraphrase or stripped from the context of the book. But a couple characters, I noticed it while I was drafting, and the refrain is better you than me. There are a couple moments, and I relate to them too, because I myself have experienced this, right? Where it's sort of you are watching, you are a bystander, and something I think, you know, you can feel like an impotent witness to so much of what's happening and the suffering around you. I really wanted to try to come at that story in this novel, and learning more about I guess it was ethnic cleansing, right? You know, the German Reich expel the Poles from their homelands, and there's also this process of Germanization of the Poles, right? The idea is just to erase them, to make them German by forbidding their language, forbidding, you know, Catholicism. So you know, that is many people's story in this country, right? A lot of us are descended from, I am, you know, from European immigrants who fled famine, poverty, but also that kind of persecution to make a new life. And I thought I had written a short story in an earlier collection called Proving Up. And it's really kind of a horror story about the Homestead Act, or you know, the agony of that, you know, the pain of being born into this context that you did not design, and feeling yourself now as this gentleman does, like, oh, I'm the colonizer in this new country. And maybe I'm a few rungs above some other people. He meets a black porter on the train ride over, and he starts to sort of understand, okay, in this place, I have a different status, right? I'm certainly not a Yankee, but you know, I exist. I have a different kind of freedom and a different status than, you know, Andrew Dawson, the black porter. I'm watching his persecution, and I'm not standing up, right? I'm sort of letting myself. I think that process of benumbment and like a kind of denial of the possibility that you might have some agency to make change. I certainly relate to that too. You know, I wouldn't have been able to write this book if I wasn't really trying to examine my own life in this same the grammar of the moral grammar of this novel. But that is something that, you know, I spoke to this brilliant historian. He's a Pawnee citizen and historian, James Ridingon. And he was very clear with me that it frustrates him when the story is the US government did this to Native people, and settlers or homesteaders really had nothing to do with it. He sent me so many newspaper articles. I mean, there definitely were people who saw the injustice of this and spoke up about it, but there were plenty of other, you know, usually, white settlers at this time and in this place who were saying, we want that land, very explicitly, that this was a land grab and that they wanted, to quote one newspaper, an Indian free environment. So this was happening really with the participation of settlers, and sometimes it was active and sometimes it was passive. But that became clear to me too, that doing nothing, if you did nothing, if you watched as sort of like the, Ponca women and children and men are kind of marched through your streets in these freezing conditions, or the Pawnee are forced to leave their homelands for a very tiny reservation in Oklahoma, which then becomes the epicenter of the Dust Bowl in no time. I mean, they leave in 1876 and the Dust Bowl is in the 30s. So this happened so quickly, and that was part of the horror story for me too. And I think if there is any one takeaway for me from having written the book, it's how important it is to shift out of this passivity or this sort of resigned, that rhetoric of self-justification. It's very familiar to me, right? Like, well, what can I do? Like, what choice do I have? And it's a great question if it's a real question, right? And I think it's even better if it's, what choices do we have? I was talking with a friend about, she, I was saying, well, what do you say to your students when they feel despondent, that like they feel so small in the face of these larger forces? And she sort of laughed, and she's like, I tell them to make a friend. And then I tell them to find a movement, basically.
I think you probably just answered this question, but I had so many other things that felt timely, that felt like they were moments of history that would repeat themselves. Like, this is the immigrant story, but not only, the Oleckys moving from Poland to escape the German, but also the Prairie Witch's family, which was Sicilian but labeled as Italian because they were lumped together by American-born citizens who did not want them in their neighborhoods. Or the treaties through which the Pawnee lost much of their Nebraska and Kansas lands. It felt like a lot of like what's happening in the Ukraine right now, or the complaint of taxpayer dollars being spent on government funding photography project, or how money can make the most heinous act seem like a sane one. After reading all that, I think I felt more dread than hope. But do you have a hope for readers of this book?
Yes, I think I do. And I'll just tell you what my experience of writing it was. And I tried to transfer some of that to the book. I think I mentioned Judy M. Gosh-Kibosh and Margaret Jacobs and Susan Grajales-Gelica, and a lot of other people are working on the Genoa Indian School Digital Reconciliation Project. And I would just encourage your listeners to go look at that online. I think I talked to so many people working on restoration in very different ways that all felt sort of in service of the same vision or dream, of a future world we want to inhabit. So I talked to, here in Oregon, Mimi Castile, who, she's an agroecologist and she's working on changing global agricultural systems, but she's also working on making her farm a test case so people can see what's possible when you put organic matter back into the soils. I mean, she was so very clear with me that we don't need to join Elon Musk's space fleet, that actually, if you follow the lines and respect the limits of nature, there will be abundance for all. And I mean, it was wonderful to talk to her. She goes all over the world and speaks at conferences about soil health, which I think is not the sexiest topic to everyone, but became like so hopeful to me. And part of it was like, oh, of course, we might not need like a carbon vacuum, that the answer is here with us. The solution really is here. And there are these processes that evolved over billions of years. And when we respect them and design our lives and policies around them, as any sane society would, there's so much potential for healing, and like on a time scale of decades, not, hundreds of years. So that was encouraging. I also, to my make a friend point, I think what was interesting was I cold called so many people. I cold called Pawnee historian James Ridingen, and I was just like some lady named Karen showing up on his phone. Like, what could be more terrifying? But he took the call, and now we're good friends. A few years later, I went with him and his family. We went on like a road trip through Pawnee homelands in Nebraska, and I got to meet the good people who were involved in the Genoa Indian School Digital Reconciliation Project. I got to meet people working on the Pawnee Seed Preservation Project. So this corn that hasn't grown in Nebraska in 150 years is growing there again because of these friendships between Nebraska farmers and Electa Hare and others who are working on, bringing Pawnee corn back to Pawnee lands. I just feel like I met kind of climate activists young people, my photographer buddy, people who are all sort of really working today, right, to make a better future a reality. And sort of like the characters in this book, like I do feel like in this unlikely way, whatever happens with this book when it goes into the world, like I have made all these real friends who are doing good things in the world. And it's the long game, right? I think Julian Uggen, who's an amazing poet and also Chamorro human rights and climate activist, told me, he said, you know, we really need longer imaginations. And that struck me too, right? Like that this really is the work of lifetimes. I mean, if getting the idea for a book in 2009 and publishing it in 2025 has taught me anything, it's that like things have their own strange gestational processes, you know? I find that encouraging and discouraging, right? But like another phrase I love is from Avery Gordon. She's a friend and a sociologist. And she said, we need to cultivate a patient urgency together because this isn't going to happen overnight. And it's going to take a lot of us working and giving our gifts in a lifeward direction together.
This book is set in the fictional town of Uz, Nebraska. And the land of Uz is from the Book of Job, but we're in Kansas, so I hope you forgive this question. When I started reading this, I felt like the antidote would be a retelling of L. Frank Baum's story, The Wizard of Oz. It's set in Uz, which is very similar to Oz, but, you know, other than the witch, the personification of a scarecrow, a town named Uz, gales, western skies, tornadoes, sepia-toned memories, and the mention of home, it felt highly original. Did you take any inspiration from The Wizard of Oz?
Man, I mean, I've seen that in so much copy now, Beth. And I'm like, yeah, oh, I guess that naming the town Uz, it's really, I mean, in the Wheel of Fortune of it all, right? It's very close to Oz. But I'm sure that book imprinted on me. I think you probably can't have like a scarecrow point of view character without courting that comparison. But I think the influence that I more consciously courted was the Book of Job, probably. You know, I think there is this farmer, Harp, who is like a reverse Job. I mean, he's a zero yield man. He's really, it would be funny if it wasn't also tragic, you know, eye level. I mean, he's been struggling. He's a bachelor, committed bachelor. He's sort of like given up hope of being a success at anything. And then on Black Sunday, all of his neighbors' crops are destroyed, but he is miraculously unharmed. And, you know, as he says, wow, this extreme fortune is extremely lonely. I mean, it's very discomforting to him and becomes quite painful. He can't figure out what to do with it or how to share it or why it's happening. It feels very much like a curse in a certain regard, or at least like the uncanniness of it, of being a success when so many others are failing, troubles him. I will just say, because this sounds like such a heavy book, I realize hearing myself talk about it, I think there's some humor, like, not as much from the scarecrow as I was expecting. Beth, the scarecrow is like a difficult choice as a point of view character because as you can all imagine, it's a little bit, it seems on its surface like a dramatically inert setup because it's just this doll staked in the same place, coming online, like kind of coming awake. I really thought that he would be sort of like the mordant stand-up comedian and actually he's quite earnest. You know, I was telling this to my best friend and she said, Karen, is that a realistic expectation? For a man made of straw, you're mad that he's not carrying his comic weight? Like, and I was like, that's fair.
Well, the book is The Antidote. Karen Russell, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Beth.
The Antidote by Karen Russell was published in paperback by Vintage. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR network. Our editors and producers for this week's show are Haley Krausen and Luann Stevens. This is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay.
Maybe you already know about naked short selling. Maybe you've personally shorted stocks yourself. But do you know about the time short sellers ruined a Super Bowl, basically?
For me, I was a little late, but red flags went up like, what is going on? This is really scary.
At Planet Money, we get the story behind the money to explain how money works. Listen on the NPR app or wherever you get your podcasts.